Helen, and please try and keep disruption to a minimum. And now I'd like to introduce the second of tonight's speakers, Vicky.
Thanks, Helen.
Thanks, Shelley. I'm Vicky, I'm an addict.
Hi, Vicky.
It's weird talking into a microphone. And I wanted to thank Carl for such a wonderful share, actually, because that was really moving. Thank you. I am terrified, you know, so I'm glad I'm amongst friends, those I know and those I don't know. It's quite nice to have some space in terms of the time to speak, though, because it means that I can just let myself sink into it, which is nice. This is also quite low. I think I'm going to do that again. Thank you very much. Cheers. I think the first thing I want to say is that my journey in recovery has not been a straight line, you know. I'm married to somebody who's been clean a long time, and he's inspirational in that way to me, which is lovely. He's not here tonight, but I kind of want to acknowledge him. I feel very emotional about that, actually. And I think the reason I feel emotional about that is, you know, because kind of the thing that really beats this disease is love. You know, that's love in here amongst those we know and love that we don't know so well. And it's like whether we like each other or not, it doesn't matter because the love's there, you know. But my journey wasn't like that. I got dragged into an NA meeting by someone who's no longer with us, who never actually managed to get it, but he 12-stepped a lot of people. And he dragged me into a meeting in 1982, and it was in Chelsea, I think, I can't remember actually, but I was pretty out of it. But the one thing that I remember out of that meeting was that this girl from America came up to me, and she picked my head up off the floor like that, and she went, "You are loved here." And through my complete state, I remembered that. Because I think it was the only thing I heard in a long time, you know? And what that gave me was the hope that recovery was possible, because at that time, I think I'd heard of one person that had cleaned up who lived in Boston, who I'd never met, but other people I knew, sort of thing. And as far as I know, he's still clean today. So it gave me hope. And I think, you know, when you live in that hopeless place of desperation and despair that we all know very well, it's a wonderful gift just to know there's some hope. And I didn't actually clean up until about another 7 years when I, you know, continued with that journey. And what happened to me was my using was very chaotic. I mean, I used to walk up and down Ladbroke Grove in one period with a shopping trolley full of bags. I used to score somewhere around there, and I'd just be wandering up and down. I don't know what I was doing. I think I was so lost. I was a bag lady. I didn't used to bath. I didn't bath for a year at a time. I was very very lost soul, you know. And what happened was that I got to, I think, 1986, and I had a daughter. And when she was 7.5 weeks old, one morning I couldn't wake up. I was so stoned still. And, you know, it was time to pick her up. She was crying, you know, to wake up and all that. And by the time I managed to wake up, she was dead. She died of a cold death. And, you know, I will never know whether I'd been not stoned, that would have made any difference. I haven't got a clue. But what that did do was it meant that the pain that I got into was bigger than the drugs that I was using. So what that meant was the drugs didn't work anymore. I could use any combination of anything and it had no effect unless I was unconscious. So I spent the next year trying very, very hard to carry on becoming unconscious. And I don't really know how I survived and stayed alive that year, because I'd spend nights just sitting injecting Chernal or Nembutal or something, and I don't know, somehow in the morning I'd still be around. But I knew about NA, and to cut a long story short, after that year I made a decision that I would come back here. I was quite arrogant about it. I thought to myself, well, I'll give them a chance. I'll give them a chance. And if I still feel as rubbish as I do now, in 6 months' time, I can just go and get a script, and that's the end of it. You know, I've got nothing to lose, basically. So I came into NA and cleaned up, became abstinent, and, you know, life took on a new colour. We took on some colour. And what I found in this fellowship from the very beginning was friendships. You know, I didn't have any money. I was living on about £2 a day. But it was okay, because life started to become good. Because suddenly I was in a different atmosphere. An atmosphere where the disease of addiction had no power. So for a powerless person to come into a place where the disease of addiction has no power is powerful. And it was for me. And, you know, I really realised as well that all I had to do was make the decision, and that the support was there to empower that decision. The support was in the 12 steps and the 12 traditions for me, and a higher power. And I didn't have a higher power at the time. I grew up in a very orthodox, Catholic-based religion. I come from an Irish Catholic family with a Jewish father who was in a lot of denial about being Jewish. And kind of didn't tell me. this has been a long journey to find the God of my understanding, and I would say I'm still on that journey. You know, but my higher power is very kind and very patient with me. For a long time, I took NA purely as my higher power, and then that's developed. I have to sort of say here that I come from a very strange family. I've been through a lot of stuff through the steps, working out my rage with my family. I hope now that I'm at a place of some kind of acceptance around the fact that we all weren't very well, you know. My father was a rageaholic. He was very disturbed. He tried to commit suicide. He did commit suicide in the end. He was a gun dealer, so we grew up with lots of guns and swords and big cannon in the front garden. And he was a very disturbed personality, and he also was a paedophile. So I'm mentioning that because I think it's important to cast the light, you know, on these things. So the whole family was very, you know, suffering from a lot of abuse. And, you know, he had his own history too. I have empathy, not for the behaviour, but for the human being that was behaving like that. My mother was an alcoholic, and we were a family of addicts, basically. So it was like, you know, it was kind of the nest. And I became a very lonely, insular child. You know, I went into myself. I was I was aware of being very affected by this disease at a very young age. And a lot of my journey in recovery has been about healing the damage that this disease causes in families, you know. And I have some relationships with some of my family members today and other people I don't, and that's okay. But it's taken a long time to get there. I didn't stay in NA. I stayed in NA for about 7 years till 96, and I made a decision to leave, broke the abstinence, and I'll tell you what happened to me was I didn't go back to being an intravenous drug user, but what happened was my codependency and my relationships and my mind blew up. I'd married, my marriage blew up, my husband relapsed. It was hell, actually. I had another daughter by this point, and I left myself in a very vulnerable position, i.e. with no fellowship. Not a good place to be on your own without support when you're dealing with somebody else who's relapsing, I can tell you, when you're not abstinent yourself. So I held together the externals, house, job, this, that. But internally, my internal world Absolutely. I remember one day sitting, I had this old Astra, I remember sitting in it outside, I was working in prison at that time, sitting outside the jail, and I had this vision of craters, like bomb craters all around me, as if I'd blown myself up, which I had really. I'd left myself with no support. And in the end, it took me into another fellowship. And then through a strange process, I came back into NA just over 5 years ago. And what brought me back into NA was a very simple thing. I was actually on a retreat in this other fellowship, and my husband, who I'm, you know, today, phoned me up and he said, I'm at the Barcelona World Convention. He said, it's absolutely incredible. He said, there are Arabs and Israelis hugging each other on the stage. He said, the United Nations can't get these people to do this. And I still had, you know, I woke up the next morning and I thought, well, I'm going to get my bullshit out of the way. Because do you know what? Whatever shit is going on in my head, NA is one of the forces, you know, greatest forces for good in the world. Because if it can achieve that, I want to be in. I'm in. I'm back. I'm coming back. And I'll tell you what, I came back, and it was difficult to come back because there's the ego problem. And I walked into the fellowship, and every single person that I knew from previously welcomed me. I was made so welcome back in this fellowship. Nobody to my face judged me. Everybody hugged me. And everybody, in a way, held me through that difficult walk back into this fellowship, for which I'm eternally grateful, actually. Because the generosity of those people is what's made it possible for me to sit here and do this share tonight, for example. And one of the things I know that's the core basis of this disease is, for me, is fear and shame. I was very afraid as a child and very ashamed as a child. And that stayed with me all my life. That's just become part of my nature, you know. And a lot of this process is about healing that shame. It's about accepting that shame. It's about knowing it's okay, actually. If I feel ashamed, actually it's okay. It's okay. Because I haven't, you know, caused this shame stuff. I'm just feeling it. It's okay to feel afraid. Because I've got a program. I've got a higher power, and I've got fellowship with good friends. And I like the word fellowship, because fellowship for me implies the word unity. And a very good friend of mine was one of our founder members, who's also obviously a very good friend of all of us, and Johnny H. And I like to remember Johnny H, because I don't often hear a lot about him. And he was one of our founder members. He's not with us anymore. He died. But without Johnny H, you know, who knows what would have happened. And he loved this fellowship, and he protected this fellowship, and I kind of want to acknowledge him here, actually, because I think that if Johnny was sitting here doing the share tonight, I think he'd be really proud. I think he'd be really proud of every single person sitting in here. I feel so emotional. You know, and life, my feeling about it is, life is a full experience. You know, it is tough at times. It is wonderful at times. It is amazing at times, and it's really boring a lot of the time. You know, and it just is what it is. And, you know, in recovery, I've been able to be there for my daughter, my second daughter. You know, I've managed to back her through university, you know, through getting jobs, through conversations like the one I had with her at 5:10 a.m. this morning when she came in from partying, but she hadn't kind of communicated very well. We had a discussion about that that was, you know, reasonable. I couldn't have done that if I was out there. If my first daughter hadn't died, she wouldn't probably have been in my life either anyway. You know what I mean? And But I could be there for my daughter today, and that's one of the most important things in my recovery, is just being there, because that's what it's about for me. That's just amazing. This is a spiritual journey. I've done things in recovery which would never have been possible. I've travelled. I've developed relationships with people. You know, my husband, I met him in Charing Cross Road in 1984. He sold me a £5 bag of Ficeptone powder. I remembered him purely because he looked really miserable. Like, that was amazing, because we all look so miserable, but he looked really miserable. And I also remembered him because it was such a good deal. And the next time I saw him, this is miraculous, really, was in an NA meeting in Blackfriars in 1994, or sometime like that. And I didn't like him, actually, and he didn't like me. And what it was, we were too scared to speak to each other, really, so we were just like, oh, you're horrible. And I just think about, that's a miracle. That's incredible. You know, that NA has brought two people together from the street like that into this family. That is amazing, you know. And definitely without this process, I don't think we would have coped together. But the thing I found that has really helped with my relationships is that we've got something called the 12 traditions. You know, and if my front room ever looks like a disaster where people are screaming and raving at each other, which does happen quite frequently, you know, I can just stop today. Simple things like I can think, principles of unity. The concept of we, not I. Right? The concept of being considerate, empathic, compassionate. Simple things like in the middle of a row, how important is it? You know, would you like a cup of tea? Just very simple things that make life so much better than it was before. And that's good. You know, I've gone through people who are close to me dying around me. There's one person in particular who I kind of like to mention, called Jonathan, who was someone I lived with for a long time. He was the father of the daughter of mine that died. He never made it into recovery, but he was always very pro-NA. He wasn't one of those using addicts that slacked off the fellowship. He always said that he thought this was a fantastic fellowship. He didn't get it, but, you know. And I had the privilege of being with him the night that he died. He didn't die of addiction, actually. He died of something else. Again, you know, just being able to be there with someone that you love when they're passing. You know, and I sat there with Jonathan, right, and I said to him, don't you think that it's time you kind of left, because it was getting to the point? And he said, it's really strange that you should say that to me. He said, but I can hear them calling me. He said, they're calling me home. And I tell you what, it was in St. John's Wood in the hospice. He was surrounded in gold. And it was the most incredible experience. And he said to me in the middle of this, he said, I've got one last message for you. He said, it's a really important message because it's a short life. He said, whatever you do in life, he said, it's really short. He said, so don't put up with shit. And you know, when you hear that from someone that's dying at that moment, that's a powerful message. And I think, you know what? I can extend that into, I don't have to give myself that sort of rubbish either. I've got this book. It's called, you know, the Blue Book, Our Basic Text. In there, it's got everything I need to live a healthy life. It contains all the principles and all the power that I need. And I've fought this process. If anyone's new around and you feel rebellious, I have fought this process. But you know what? The process won, just for today. And I'm grateful. You know, I don't have to go and, I hear it a lot, but I'm going to say it, I don't have to go and use today. I don't have to go and get some horrible, filthy syringe out of the bin and sharpen it on a matchbox. I'm not often in touch with this stuff, actually, because my life's very different to that. I've just got some serious gratitude coming up, sitting here now. I feel so privileged that I've been given this opportunity by this fellowship to live a different life to that. And you know what's really kind of sad? I kind of feel like I want to pick that person up that was using, the me that was using. Because what that person was that was using was just a tortured child. Really a tortured child. And, you know, I don't have to go back there and be re-tortured. And one of the things I would also say, if anyone's coming back in or coming back in off a relapse, there is no shame in coming back. You know, you are worthy, just as worthy as anybody else. Everybody in here is equally worthy. Everybody in here deserves love. No one, you know, is any better or worse. Because I know how tough it is to walk back in. We're just powerless over our addiction and it made our life unmanageable. That's all. Coming to believe in a power greater than ourselves that can restore us to sanity. Sanity. I am still insane. I'm still really bad tempered. I moan a lot. I think I'm right all the time. I'm really intolerant, judgmental, and quite nasty at times. But I've also, as Carl said, I've also got a good heart. And that's what I have to work with, is my heart. Because if I can sit in my heart and I can develop a we with you, this is what it's about. You know, and often I don't feel like coming to a meeting. Often I just want to sit at home and be insular and play Angry Birds or whatever other little avoidance I can find, you know. And just to have the willingness sometimes to go against that nature, that negativity. I mean, I don't know how anybody else feels in here, but I've got a very negative head at times. You know, I have to work on being positive. I have to think, right, let's go for it. You know, be positive. Because often I don't feel like that. And sometimes I go through periods and months where I feel quite depressed. And I just have to work through that and keep working through that and working through that and pick up the phone, you know, and get to a meeting or be kind to myself. It's like the question is, how can I be kind to myself, you know? God Almighty, I never even considered. Do you know, when I was using, I didn't know what fear was. I'm afraid. Whatever, you know. And I remember once when I was in treatment, they said to me, you're very manipulative. I said, what does that mean? Honestly, I hadn't got a clue what they were talking about. And I hated getting confronted. I hated it. I know some people like groups in treatment because they know how to play it, but I was just like, don't talk to me like that. I remember waiting for the result of an HIV test in one treatment centre one day, so I was all really, you know, really worried and really everything, you know. And this bloke, who obviously had his issues, got really angry and he threw a chair at me, called me a bitch. I was absolutely horrified. How dare you? But I think now I look back on that and laugh. It's great. You know, in time, the most horrendous things kind of develop this kind of satirical humour, you know, and even the thing with the trolley in Ladbroke Grove. I mean, every time I drive up Westbourne Grove, I think, for God's sake. But it's part of life's experience, you know. I mean, there are, you know, it's great. I'd rather be someone that had pushed a trolley up Ladbroke Grove, done a few other things. At least I've got, there's some interest factor going on. Because I can't sing, I can't dance. And one thing I do that I find really helps me is I really like writing. I think it's really important in recovery. For me, it's been really important to find my muse, you know, to find that creative force. Because everything out there in the world is so much about, you know, making money, do this, survive, da-da-da. It's been really important to find that creative muse and to find that time for myself. And I find that writing's really, really helped. And I have to admit in here, because it's an honest programme, that at one point I voted Tory. Because I thought, very honest. So anyway, I kind of worked through that. I did say I had insanity problems. We don't get better in a day. So anyway, I mean, and actually it was quite good, because if I hadn't voted Tory, I'd never have done this. And I got through this process with it, and I wrote this rap song. It was really good. I put it on Facebook, so if you're my friend, you can read it. And it was an apology to the North East for voting for a beast. I'm sorry if you voted Tory, you get it, something like that. But it's like, you know, the creative end of that process was, I'm 52, I'm middle-aged, I grew up in Bishop Stortford, I wrote a rap song, and I put it on Facebook, and it's all right, actually. Stephen's right. So what I'm saying is there's lots of, we don't have to be totally ashamed, do we? We can do lots of things with our shame that are creative, exciting, fun, and enjoyable. It doesn't all have to be really, really heavy. It's like making amends. I want to talk about this. Amends. I had such good fun making an amends the other night. I owed the Hawelli restaurant £25 from 1980-something because I was really starving. And me and my boyfriend went in there, we ate like pigs, and we drank 3 bottles of wine. Right? And we didn't pay. So we didn't have any money. So what happened was the police turned up. And they drove us back, I don't know why they did this, because they were quite nice to us. They drove us back to our squat in Brixton, and they said it wasn't fit for human habitation, so they wouldn't leave us there because they didn't believe we could live there. So we had another squat a few doors up, so we took them there, but we had to climb in the front window because the front door was kind of locked, and they left us there then. I thought, I look back. So anyway, I thought, I've never made this financial amends. It's, you know, I've got this time to go back. So I went the other night. This is how higher power works. This is evidence of my higher power. I went in there and I said, James, please come with me. James, my husband. I said, please come with me. It would just be really nice. So we went in there and we had this amazing meal. Like, I didn't expect it to be amazing. And it was really good. And I wasn't worried about a diet that night. I thought, I'm going to blow it out here. And I thought, I knew what I was going to do. I was going to leave £25 in the tip. So James, being James, said to the owner, are you the same owner that was there in 1980? So then he looked at me and he went, it's okay, it's the spirit of the amends. It doesn't matter if it's the same owner, you know. So it was really good. So we had this lovely meal, we spoke to the owner. And the really interesting thing about this was, he said, it's been there like, I don't know, it's got to have been there for over 30 years, that place. He said, we're closing in 4 weeks. And the only reason I got into that restaurant that night was because I have a friend who's very sick in hospital at the moment, and we'd been to visit him. And if I hadn't gone to that hospital to visit him, I wouldn't have been on the way coming there. I wouldn't have made the amends. So it's just that little bit of action. And then, you know, I found with a lot of amends, I can have quite good fun. I made a great amends to my daughter, actually, when she was 18. It felt like the right time. I took her for, again, a nice meal. I like making amends around nice meals because I'm a foodie. And I said to her, Anna, I said, I've got something to say to you, and I want you to listen, and you don't have to rescue me, okay? So she's really like, what now, you know? What's the mad woman doing now? So I said, I've got to tell you that I really have to say I wasn't able to be emotionally available for you when you were growing up, when your dad relapsed, when I was off my head. I'm so sorry that I wasn't able to be emotionally available for you, because I know that you suffered, you know. And I just went through this process with her, and her eyes, I tell you what, we'd had quite a difficult relationship for a few years because of all this stuff, and that night changed our relationship, because it set a different foundation. Because what happened was she saw that it wasn't her fault. On cue. And Do you know, it completely changed the relationship. And I now have a fantastic friendship with my daughter today. That's the most precious thing. Forget the bits of, you know, whatever we've gathered, too many clothes or whatever. It doesn't matter. The most important thing is, for me, that relationship with my daughter. You know, one daughter died, another daughter down to the process of fellowship. It's not, you know, and she's well and she's doing, and it's, I feel so grateful for that to you guys, because without you, this wouldn't, that would not, honestly, wouldn't be there. And sponsorship, I've had very loving sponsors in NA, in NA and other fellowships, and I think that without those women to guide me and show me the way and listen to, you know, get me getting stuff off my chest and going through the steps with them, it's just been a miraculous process. And and somebody in here once, not a sponsor, but somebody said to me years ago, I was absolutely in a state, and I was in a car with this person who's still around, and they had a packet of Marlboro, because it was when everyone was still smoking, so everybody was smoking, and they got this packet of Marlboro and they went, look, all you've got to do is hand it over. And I looked at this cigarette packet like that. But, you know, I thought they were nuts. I tell you what, I never forgot that, and it came back to a point in my life where I learned that that was all I had to do, was simply have faith and hand it over, whatever it was. And yes, I've got to put the footwork in. But by doing that and having that faith of handing it, I can't deal with this, please, please, you know, help. Miraculous things, thank you, Shelley. Miraculous things happened. A lot of incredible things happened. You know, and I've survived through the father's suicide and the mother's death from alcoholism and the, you know, stuff that's gone on at work and, you know, the life stuff that happens to people. And not only have I survived through it, but I've got a measure of self-acceptance. A measure. I've got a measure of freedom. And I just want to get on with it. I want to build more relationships with you guys. I want to share more. I want to carry on with this process, because I'll tell you this time, I know this. I know it's just for today, but I also know I'm here for life. You know, and I know I'm not going anywhere. This time the foundation is absolutely rock solid. So thank you very much and appreciate it.